London is a place filled with many, many people. Some great, some not so great, some big, some small. Over the previous 152 chapters of this podcast, we've covered a lot of people, a lot of Londoners, almost all of them men, who have strode upon its streets and left their legacy upon this city. And sometimes that legacy can last for centuries. And sometimes their legacy lasts to this day. One such man was Dick Whittington. No, not the man in the pantomime story, but the real man, whose entry into the tale of London we covered back in chapter 142. Here we are, 9 chapters later, and his story was about to come to an end. But in the last years of his life, and in the shadow of his legacy, London was to find itself dealing head-on with a sudden dramatic change in both economic circumstances and political situations. Suddenly, after decades, the entire length of Whittington's political career, the London economy began to surge. The seemingly endless recession that had dragged London down for almost a generation or more was lifting. There was hope in the air. But it was a fragile hope, mixed with cynicism and above all, fear. Because there were many factors that could drag London back down. And those old ghosts of London's passions, hatred of foreigners, political factionalisation, responses to national instability, these all arose like eternal spectres to haunt the city. And in the shadow of the death of Dick Whittington, London actually found itself about to go to war, north of the river against south of the river. Seriously. A crazy few years suddenly erupt, through which a young infant boy, the King Henry VI, was dragged on endless processions back and forth through the streets of the city. Huge amounts of capital taken from France suddenly starts being poured into the coffers. The most expensive galley ever to arrive from Venice suddenly reaches the docks, and more. Hi, my name is Saul, and this is The Story of London, the podcast that tries to tell the narrative events of the city chronologically. We're in the opening years of the very, very long reign of King Henry VI of England, one of the most important and profound eras of English history. And whereas last chapter we strolled across the Channel to study what was going on in the Hundred Years' War, this week we're back in London and back to the story of this amazing city, as one of its most beloved mayors passes from this earth, and the events in the years that follow that. Welcome then to chapter 153 of this story of London, In the Shadow of Whittington. We begin with Grey Friars Priory. This monastery had stood where it was built for hundreds of years by now, located besides Newgate Street, which was the road that ran directly to Newgate. It was easily one of the larger monasteries of London, and between it and the busy street was a row of cheap houses that people could rent, owned by the monastery, which separated it from the hustle and bustle. A single gate, which opened onto Newgate Street, led into the complex behind this, where two large cloisters surrounded beautiful and ornate religious buildings. And it was here that a library was founded, one of the first we have ever heard mentioned of in London. The recent mayor, Richard Whittington, provided £400 with which to build and furnish this library, and laid the foundation stone on the 21st of October, 1421. Much later, a survey of the building summed up what was built as follows. Quote, "The north side of the great cloister was occupied by Whittington's library, which escaped destruction in the fire and survived in a somewhat mutilated condition until 1827. It is said to have been 129 feet long and 31 feet broad. This shows that its east end was flush against the east wall of the east side of the cloister, and its west end was at the northwest inner corner of the cloister. The Repentory book records there were 28 desks and settles in the library, and also there be certain old books upon the said desks, unquote. It was a majestic place of learning, located away from the hustle and bustle of the streets of London, and of course the squalor of nearby Newgate and its prison. It wasn't the only religious building being changed in London that year. We know the parishioners of St. Michael's Church in Cornhill rebuilt their steeple with three tiers, but Whittington's Library began in 1421 is the most noticeable. But it's not the only landmark that in 1421 created by Dick Whittington. Well, supposedly. What follows is a story that was later embellished by London tradition. Because right now, it is said, Dick Whittington, Mayor of London, created the building that was actually the cause of much of his later fame. It was in 1421, he constructed, or ordered the construction, of the Whittington Longhouse, a.k.a. the Whittington Drop, a.k.a. London's first public toilet with separate booths for men and women. Now, while this particular privy was constructed, we have to take on board that it actually may have been built a few years from now and not in 1421. The funds granted after Whittington died, we're not 100% sure. What we do know is over in Vintry Ward, beside the river, was something actually a little bit more elaborate and complex than just a public toilet. It appeared that Whittington, either while living or just after his death, built a load of houses for the poor residents of the ward, which are known as almshouses. A later review of the evidence about this complex of buildings, written in 1972, says, quote, "The longhouse and the almshouses, over which Whittington established in Vintry Ward, were unostentatious and could never have become a public monument to an eminent citizen. Indeed, this far-sighted benefaction seems almost to have been forgotten. We read of it first in the 17th century, a time when the inhabitants of Vintry Ward were moved to against its destruction," unquote. What was built was a series of houses for the poorer residents of the ward of Vintry. And these were located above a longhouse. This longhouse was the public toilet, also known at the time as a house of easement. The structure of the toilet block itself was indeed long. It consisted of two long rows of 64 toilet seats, without stalls, just seats. But crucially, they were separated, so one side was for men, and in a separate private part, another side was for women. The seats themselves overhung a low, narrow gully that discharged into the Thames, and that got flushed out by each tide. And above these were built a series of flats for those who were too poor to afford rents and therefore required charity or alms, hence why they were known as almshouses. Now please note, there was nothing especially unhygienic in people living above privies. I mean, at that time, there was a cesspit under or adjoining most of the houses of London. But basically what Whittington had done was provide five or six rooms over the privies for the almsfolk of the parish of St. Martin Vintry, and provided for the upkeep of these flats from the rent of at least one other house in the parish. These rooms above the long privies were located where today we'll find Bell Wharf Lane, and we know that they lasted some time, only finally actually being removed in the 17th century. This was indicative of the man, public works for the common good. Not all of them flashy. But this large public toilet down by the riverside, the Whittington Longhouse, was to become, at least in terms of folklore, one of this former mayor's longest lasting legacies. But it was not the longest lasting legacy. See, Richard Dick Whittington died in 1423. About 12 years after his death in 1436, some unknown London poet wrote the following words in tribute to him, quote, "And in worship now think I on the son of Mercandy, Richard of Whittington, that lodestar and chief chosen flower? What hath by him our England of honour? And what profit hath been of his wretches, and yet lasteth daily in worthiness? That pen and paper may not me suffice him to describe, so high he was of price, above merchants to set him on the best. I can no more, but God have him in rest." Unquote. Within a dozen years of his death, Whittington was being lionized by London. He'd had a long and conspicuous career, serving 3.5 terms as mayor. As well as his original half term as mayor when he was put into position by Richard II, he was subsequently elected in the years 1398 to 1399, 1406 to 1407, and then recently in 1419 to 1420. Back in 1416, he was elected as a Member of Parliament for London, and Henry V had appointed him to supervise the completion of the refit of Westminster Abbey. His mayoralty, his money, and his posthumous charity immediately made him the subject of local legend. He left no widow, no children, and decided that his great fortune should go to charity. He had, quote, "right liberal and large hands to the needy and the poor people," unquote. Now, like all men of this era, Richard Whittington's principal worry for after his death was that his soul should gain enough prayers to speed it through the cleansing fires of purgatory. As the death, then purgatory, and then finally heaven pipeline was a pretty established route in medieval theology, this would of course be his overwhelming priority. And as such, given that the prayers of poor people were somewhat of a higher quality for this particular purpose, he directed his attention to the purpose with a myriad of charitable deeds and donations. His wife, Alice Fitzwarren, had died back in July 1412 after a long illness, and since he had no surviving children, and he seemed to have no intention of remarrying, Whittington focused his attention on a legacy, not for some heir, but for his soul, and made London the inheritor of his fortune. This process began long before his death. In 1409, he began to rebuild his parish church of St. Michael Paternoster Royal, which was located just south of his home. He financed substantially the rebuilding of the Guild Hall. He financed a ward for unmarried mothers at St. Thomas's Hospital. He paid for drainage systems for areas around Billingsgate and Cripplegate. And as we've just said, the almshouses and public privy in the parish of St. Martin Vintry, as well as the principal and substantial donation for the establishment of Greyfriars Library. The excellent historian of the Mercers of London, Anne Sutton, summed up the situation in his will as follows, quote, "No details were set out in his will of 1421, made 2 years before his death, which mentioned many conventional objects of charity and instructed that all his property be sold and spent on masses for his soul and works of charity. This was to give his executors complete freedom, as he knew they would act as he intended," unquote. Whittington basically created a massive fund, liquidating everything he had, and then had this fund be spent in his name. And the operation and expenditure of this was overseen by his executors, men who he had not only trusted with this great gift, but he understood they were of a like mind. And some of the money from his will was used to rebuild Newgate Prison. It was used to build the first library in Guildhall, the ancestor of the modern Guildhall Library, to make substantial repairs to St. Bartholomew's Hospital, to build almshouses and an adjoining hospital, and install some of the first public drinking fountains. These original trustees of his will included the Common Clerk of London between 1417 and 1438, John Carpenter, the parson of St. Michael Paternoster, John White, gave up his post to not only become a trustee, but also to oversee the building of the South Gate of St. Bart's Hospital, and he went on to become the Master of St. Bart's. The trustees included the fellow mercer and soon-to-be mayor John Coventry and the scrivener William Grove. Between them, they had at their disposal a fortune of between £6,500 and £7,000, of which about 1,200 was in land, and the rest was in jewels, bonds, and plates. Whittington's two main foundations, a college of six priests and almshouses that went with it, were established quickly on land loaned by Whittington near the church of St. Michael Paternoster Royal, right in the heart of the city, and these were completed by December 1421. The almshouses was to be directly administered by the Mercer's Company, with some reference to the mayor helping out. Significantly, while the trustees oversaw the expenditure of his donation, it was the Company of Mercers that ran the landed estates, found tenants, collected rents, and paid over the funds. By the time the Mercers were in full possession of all the property, the rents amounted to just over £250 per year. The Mercers' Company had now suddenly become a major landlord in the city. In effect, with Whittington's will, the Mercers had been handed the means to ensure its own institutional perpetuity as an administrator of charity, whatever may happen to the individual members or the trade of the Mercers. Whittington's example showed exactly what a citizen who had the money to bequeath might do for London, as well as what he might do for his reputation and also what he might do for his soul. He showed the livery company how it could administer estates for charitable purposes and benefit also. Now, sure, Dick Whittington wasn't the first man to do it, but what was exceptional about Whittington's charity was its overall effect on the city, the sheer size of the foundation with the Mercers, and how much it impacted upon the people around him. That charity of Dick Whittington still exists, by the way, to this day, still overseen by the Mercers' Company of London. A cursory click on the UK Register of Charities shows that last year it spent, well, last accounts, it spent £5.7 million on charitable enterprises, and currently owns and runs two modern-day almshouses for the care of the elderly, one in London and the other, I believe, in East Grinstead. Since 1423, it has remained an active charity. And this, more than anything else, has been Dick Whittington's truest legacy upon London. But while London at this time would have probably wished to see that, I don't know, the most important event of this time being the creation of a public privy inventory, unfortunately it was not. Henry V had died, and without him, the entire geopolitical world was changing. London records describe the impact his death had on the city in an immediate sense. William Waldeny, the Mercer, who is now in his second term as Mayor of London, oversaw the city where instructions about how to greet the return of the body of their fallen king were quite detailed. Quote, "After the streets of the city and the borough of Southwark have been cleansed, the mayor, sheriffs, recorder, aldermen and officers, and the more sufficient persons of the whole city shall proceed on foot as far as St. George's Bar, clothed in black vestments, together with 300 torches borne by 300 persons clothed in white gowns and hoods, and there reverently salute the corpse, following it the first day as far as St. Paul's Church, where the funeral obsequies take place, and the second day to Westminster," unquote. So yeah, Henry V, whose arrival in London after the Battle of Agincourt had seen the wildest, most colourful display of medieval showmanship the city had ever seen, as we covered in chapter 149, now returned to the city to be met by a lavish display of public mourning. This grand procession, with hundreds of London's great and good, dressed in sepulchre colours of black and white, and illuminated by torches, snaked through the city. But London intended, probably from demand, that everyone should be able to take part in this procession of grief, not just the great and the good. The instructions go on to say, quote, "It is likewise provided that through the street from the post or slopes to the end of the bridge towards Southwark, as far as the corner of the crossroads at Eastcheap, shall stand on either side, the men of the wards of Bridge and Billingsgate with lighted torches, and that the chaplains of the churches and chapels within said wards shall stand at the doors of churches, habited in their richest vestments, and bearing in their hands censers of gold and silver, while they solemnly chant the Venite and incense the corpse as it passes. The like shall be done by the men of the wards of Langbourne, Aldgate, Portsoken, and Lemstrait, from the corner of the said crossroads at Eastcheap up to Cornhill, and by the wards of Cornhill, Breadstreet, Walbroke, and Vintry, from the corner up to Lestrokes, and by the wards of Colmanstreet, Bassishaw, Breadstreet, and Baynard's Castlid, from Lestrokes up to the Great Conduit, and by the wards of Cheap, Cordwainerstreet, Cripplegate, and Aldrichgate, from the Great Conduit to the West Gate of St. Paul's, unquote. Hundreds, if not thousands, were taking part as the procession made its way in a circular route around the crowded streets of London. For me, the image of the torch-led procession, illuminating vast amounts of incense and echoed with priests speaking the dirges of the dead, is a haunting and powerful image, a grand pageant of mourning. But in amidst all these details of this grand pageant, there is something in the small print about this procession, one clue about something else going on in the city. We read when it came to the processions that they listed, quote, "These are the names of the mysteries which provided the torches, the remains of which were returned to them, the mercers, 12 torches," unquote. It then went on through the other guilds who provided the torches. And listed amongst those guilds that provided 12 were the mercers, the grocers, the drapers, the pelters, the vinters, and the fishmongers. But then, just before the long-established ironmongers who produced 8 torches, the tailors come in with 12 torches provided. The note goes on to say that when you added together all the torches provided by the livery companies in London, they came to a grand total of, quote, 211 torches, and note that the chamberlain at the cost of the commonalty gave to each torchbearer a gown and hood of blanket, unquote. So, well, this lists livery companies and how many torches each of the companies would provide. Because it was describing the order of the largest companies from the most important to the least, there, just below the fishmongers and now above the ironmongers, was the tailors, joining the big 6 other companies of, you know, the likes of the mercers, the grocers, the drapers, and the vinters. The appearance of the tailors here is important, but we'll come back to why it's important in a moment. Anyway, the city mourned this huge king in a festival of light. The torchbearers escorted the body from Southwark across the streets in a pageant of grief and mourning all around the city to St. Paul's, and the next day from St. Paul's to Westminster. But this was not the end of the mourning. Whether from national pride at his conquests or a more personal affection for the glory days, the citizens of London were to observe the anniversary of Henry V's death throughout his son's long reign. The grocers' company recorded in their accounts the yearly cost of hiring a barge to take the company to Westminster to attend the late king's annual dirge and requiem. This was an act of homage which Londoners had accorded to none of his predecessors, not Edward I, not Edward III, nor Henry II, nor even Richard Coeur de Lion, not even Edward the Confessor, Ethelred, or even Alfred the Great. No, it was Henry V alone they commemorated a yearly requiem, and it established the ceremonial journey on a barge rowed by 8 oarsmen as part of the Grocers Company's civic year. The king was dead. Henry V had changed the geopolitical situation of the world around them. And we know that, as the principal city of England, London's importance gained some special correspondence. 2 letters arrived in the city, addressed to the city's leaders, that were recorded soon after. The first, quote, "Letter from the Duke of Bedford to the Mayor, Aldermen and Commonalty, notifying them on account of the decease of the late king, the government of the realm, by the laws, ancient usage and customs of the said realm, have fallen to him, as being the late king's eldest brother, dated Rouen, 26th of October, unquote. And this was joined by a, quote, letter from the provost of merchants, Echevins and Burgesses residing in Paris to the mayor, Burgesses, inhabitants of the city of London, touching on the death of Henry V, asking them to use their influence with the powers that be for the protection of France against her enemies, and assuring them of the allegiance of the writers to Henry VI, who is king both of France and England, written at Paris, unquote. The Duke of Bedford saw the importance of writing to London to allow the powerful forces of the city know that ultimately he was in charge. And the peers of London and Paris wrote to the city to ask for their help and advocacy in the time to come. And they would need advocacy, as would London, because the times to come were indeed messy. Of course, this now leads to how things were going to be run domestically. And here, London found itself being dragged into the complicated politics of the regency of a young king, almost straight away. But why London was to pick a side, and to be blunt, from the point of view of history, certainly pick the wrong side, is a rather complicated tale of personal politics and economic forces. London's politics, as we've often said, was always influenced by its economy and the fortunes of the political power brokers of the city. And with the death of Henry V, it was dragged again into the mix. Which is a nice way to say, here we go, this is the political mess that erupted in the aftermath of the death of Henry V in England. On his deathbed, the king had given instructions as to how affairs were to be carried out after he died and during the minority of his son, which could last some time. John, the Duke of Bedford, brother of the late king, was, as we detailed last chapter, was placed in charge of everything happening in France. Meanwhile, the King Henry's younger brother, Humphrey, the Duke of Gloucester, who, while the king was in France, had been acting as warden of the realm, was confirmed in that office. This appointment did raise a few eyebrows, as some felt the Duke of Gloucester was in many ways an unsuitable man to be entrusted with the delicate task of governing a somewhat disturbed country during a long minority. Meanwhile, the formal and all-important post of guardian of the infant son of the king, the baby Henry VI, seems to be entrusted to the old Duke of Exeter, Thomas Beaufort, half-brother of Henry IV, and he was assisted in his duties by Lord Fitzhugh and Sir Walter Hungerford. These three dukes, upon whom the future of England fell upon, were very differing characters. The Duke of Bedford was brilliant. He was 33 at the time of his brother Henry's death, and while not as brilliant as him, he was intelligent and a steady man, a reliable character, and was genuinely looked up to and respected by all as a trustworthy and serious statesman. Bedford appeared to be possessed of a high sense of public duty, and he quickly earned the respect of the French as well by his commitment to justice and the comparative humanity of his administration in their land. He presented himself as being above politics, and while he always got on well with his brother, the Duke of Gloucester, he also provided a much-needed check upon his younger brother's more wayward passions. Bedford, we will see, used his immense diplomatic talents to having a quieting effect upon the many disturbances of the peace. And during his rare appearances in England, it usually ended up with him being the one who would ease ruffled feathers and calm violent egos. Please don't think he is this tree-hugging marriage counsellor type, by the way. Bedford was a warrior, a steel-eyed general, and as Joan of Arc was about to discover a few years from now, he was utterly, brutally ruthless when he needed to be. But still, that was him. His younger brother Humphrey, the Duke of Gloucester, on the other hand, was somewhat more ambitious and self-seeking. He did not have the same deft touch as his older brothers had and seemed to lack the same focus on public service as them. As well as that, as we mentioned last chapter and later in this one, his actions seriously jeopardised the Anglo-Burgundian alliance that was winning the war in France, and he did not grasp his older brother's understanding of real politics by the looks of things. Gloucester was far more the type of man to inflame pride and armchair general the war than fight it. On top of this, in the years to come, his quarrels with the Bishop of Winchester and later the Queen of England were to have a dramatic and mostly negative impact upon the nation. The third part of this trinity of power was Thomas Beaufort, who'd been in his younger days a headstrong and violent young man, but was now the more sober elder statesman of the three. But Thomas Beaufort was not long for the world, and he was replaced by his older brother in this trinity of power, Henry Beaufort, the Bishop of Winchester, a man who went on to become a cardinal. Henry Beaufort was ambitious, energetic, and highly capable. He was one of those great clerical statesmen who rose in an age where education was mostly in the hands of the church. He was smart, well-read, and a man whose influence was eventually felt throughout the whole of Europe. And as well as that, Henry Beaufort was also by far the richest man in England. As you can imagine, this gave him a monumental ego. And this ego brought him into collision with many, in particular his nephew, the Duke of Gloucester, who he utterly and happily and completely detested. The Bishop of Winchester was a huge presence in England and upon London, and there is no way he could be ignored by Henry VI's Regency Council. Always better to have such a man inside the tent pissing out than outside the tent pissing in. I mean, fundamentally, he was the greatest wool merchant in England at this time. These three men became the chief individuals at the head of affairs in England in 1422. In that year, the Privy Council met on the 30th of September and issued writs for a parliament to be summoned on the 9th of November. And trouble began between them only a few days before it met. See, the Lords did not look too favourably upon the Duke of Gloucester, and fearing his ambition, decided to place some checks and balances upon him. Please note, this desire to, one, place checks and balances upon Gloucester, and two, initiate a system of a more council-based ruling during the minority of Henry VI. Well, yeah, Henry Beaufort was going to be the main beneficiary of this, him and his family. Accordingly, on the 5th of November, the Duke of Gloucester was authorised by the council to open and dissolve Parliament only, quote, by assent of the council, unquote, and not in his own right, as he was supposed to do as Warden of the Realm. The young Duke strongly objected to this, protesting that this command was unusual, and, well, you know, he's the Warden. That's his job, damn it. In spite of his protest, however, the Lords replied that, quote, considering the King's age, they could not, ought not, and would not otherwise consent, but that these words, or others having similar import, should be inserted for the security of the aforesaid Duke and of themselves in time to come, unquote. And in the face of a unified council, Gloucester had to take it. When Parliament did open on the 9th of November, 2 days after the funeral obsequies of Henry V were completed, the Duke of Gloucester faced even greater frustration. He put forward a claim to the full regency of the kingdom, but Parliament finally decided to make the Duke of Bedford, quote, protector of the realm and Church of England and the King's chief counsellor, unquote, while Gloucester was only to exercise this power when his older brother was absent. Of course, as Bedford went on to pay only one visit of any significant length to England, the Duke of Gloucester got this job and these powers in practice. But the way it was worded was a bit of a severe snub, and the knowledge that his excellent brother could at any time be called back in to check him, well, it was frustrating. Gloucester was allowed to make appointments to many of the small offices of state, but he was obliged to ask the advice of the council with regard to the more important ones. We can imagine his nose was somewhat utterly put out at this point. Who is this council we talk of? Well, that's the Regency Council of England, which formerly had 17 members upon it. It was made up of the Duke of Gloucester, who we just said, and the mild-mannered Henry Chicherley, the discreet and rather modest Archbishop of Canterbury, and the Bishop of Winchester, who we just mentioned. There were a couple more bishops, and then as an extra one, you had the Bishop of London there. You had the Duke of Exeter and the Earls of March, Warwick, Northumberland and Westmoreland, and finally the Earl Marshal, Lords Cromwell and Fitzhugh, Sir Walter Hungerford, Sir John Tiptoff and Sir Walter Beauchamp. So these were the big powers that be, the great and the good, the national figures. But this is the story of London, and London's politics was all about the local, and London's local politics was driven entirely by economics. And the economic news from London was actually, surprisingly, positive. London's economy had begun to bounce back, especially following the peace treaty with France and the restoration of unimpeded commercial relations between London and the continental markets. As a consequence of this, and also because of gold imported in from Italy, together with some silver which Venice had obtained from Serbia and Bosnia, there was a noticeable increase in the bullion arriving in London, and we see a subsequent increase in the output of the London Mint between 1421 and 1425. Suddenly that coin shortage that had bedeviled the city for years was finished. Meanwhile, the wool staple of Calais was also restored successfully. The king's conquest in France and his acknowledgement as the heir to the French throne raised the not unreasonable expectation from Londoners that at last the sacrifices they had made for the war would bear fruit and the long recession would finally come to an end. And the signs at first seemed to promise this. A Venetian galley in 1421 landed one of the richest cargoes of spices, silks and other rich fabrics ever brought to London, which was valued by the customs at £6,848. But of course, this promise of economic good times took another kick between the legs in September 1422 when the news arrived that Henry V was dead. The shock and grief of the citizens was profound, as we know. But to the great displays of mourning must also now be added fears of what this meant for the economic recovery. But if we go back to that list of the tortures carried by the guilds of London and the importance of those guilds, I said we should pay attention to how well the tailors were doing. Indeed, from the size of their contribution, it had become clear that over the years leading up to this moment, the Tailors' Guild had now joined the ranks of the greater companies, enriched as some of their members were by their dealing in cloth, and there was a reason for this. Within 10 years of now, the value of England's cloth exports would go beyond that of England's wool exports, and London livery companies were basically to reflect this fundamental shift that was taking place in the national economy in the years leading up to it. We see this shift in the 40 Londoners that took part in a meeting of the Merchant Adventurers of London in Antwerp in 1421. 36 of these were mercers, and it was the mercers' company that the adventurers looked through for organisation, like the grocers had given the support to the staplers back in the 1380s. Keep this in mind, and keep also in mind that while the sense of dread caused by the English king dying was not unjustified, the city's financial and commercial recovery did continue after he died. Despite the fear that without him, as the general of the English forces, the glittering French ransoms and all the revenue from confiscated estates might soon be no more, the campaigns in France continued for some years to stimulate the economy of London by providing new capital and employment. At least 8 grocers joined the retinues of nobles and gentry who sought their military fortunes in France in the late 1420s. And others made money as victuallers for the royal armies. And I have to mention here, a grocer of London who had moved to Guildford, a man called John Gregg, was employed at least 4 times in the 1420s to victual the forces in France. And I only mention this to say that here in the 1420s, we have evidence that the armies of the Hundred Years' War were being fed by Greggs. I had to say that one. Treasure from France continued to flow into London for years to come. And you saw this pipeline where profits from the war went to commanders and went from the commanders to the London merchants and businessmen who'd invested for them. The best example, in 1426, John Wells began to employ as mercantile capital the profits of the military campaigns of Sir John Fastolf, the nephew of Hugh Fastolf, who had risen through the ranks and the fortunes of war to become the king's lieutenant in Normandy. In 1424, he was said to have won a fortune via the Battle of Verneuil, and in 1426, he sent via Lombardy money exchanges 20,000 marks and 8,000 gold crowns to John Wells in London. And these proved to be only the first of many consignments which he invested with Wells as his personal banker and man of business. The money was kept in Wells' hands for several years, with instructions often, quote, to merchandise with it, unquote. The recovering economy of London showed itself too in the temporary increase in the exports of wool through the city during the 1420s. But what the records seem to show was that now Calais' wool staple was back as the main and only legal location for the selling of English wool. A cabal of English and probably London-based merchants began to dominate its trade. They introduced new stiffer regulations at Calais, and these limited the wool merchants' freedom to sell their wool where they wanted to, and severely restricted their sales on credit. The stapler faction still had some teeth. And there's certainly evidence from the petition which the staplers presented in Parliament in 1423 against wool being taken directly to Holland, Zealand and Flanders, that some merchants were seeking to avoid the Calais staple. The evidence suggests that these regulations were turning the Calais Fellowship of Wool Merchants into a tight monopolistic cartel. Any Londoners who were unwilling or unable to submit to such trading restrictions did find Holland and Zealand attractive alternative markets. I mean, the Dutch were demanding even greater supplies of wool, and the market for English cloth was also booming after 1423. London dominated the cloth trade, so it became a growing lifeline for London's mercers, London's merchant adventurers, and those members of London's grocers who were not part of the new powerful Calais monopoly. This led, of course, to a fear of traders from these regions and the Flemish traders undermining this trade and the London market again. This revived the London campaign to protect their trade. And we see it in Robert Shkreli's mayoralty in 1421, with a city ordinance once again forbidding foreigners to act as brokers. This was followed up in the Parliament a year later, in which two grocers, John Mitchell and Thomas Maynold, represented the city, presenting a petition to the Commons protesting against alien brokers who raised the price of merchandise. It didn't really work, because in October 1424, the city repeated its ordinance. And they were doing this because even though London's export trade was suddenly hitting a new peak of prosperity not seen in decades, especially between the years 1424 and 1429, there was a parallel increase in foreigners trading in London. And this created a feeling of nervousness and concern in the merchants of London and by extension in the people who profited from them. And this was the background of underlying fears and resentments that became the centre of a huge political row. Now, for reasons that will become clear in a moment, the clash started with Gloucester's ambition to recover the county of Hainault over in the Low Counties. From the point of view of the Bishop of Winchester, Gloucester's personal ambitions threatened to destroy the alliance with Burgundy, on which English power in France largely rested. And I mean, he wasn't wrong, and his brother, the Duke of Bedford, as we know from last chapter, was feeling the implications of Gloucester's move. However, to the mercers of London, to merchants adventurers based in London, to many of London's grocers, these powerful factions within the city, Gloucester's move opened the possibility of extending English influence and power over Hainault, Holland and Zeeland, the counties through which English cloth penetrated the markets of Northern Europe. See, for London, if Hainault came under Burgundian control, they feared that Duke Philip of Burgundy, who was at this time the Count of Flanders, could impose there the policy he currently had in Flanders of prohibiting imports of English cloth. And then, as well as all these groups in London supporting any kind of takeover of Hainault, the staplers of London began to hope that if Gloucester actually won control of Hainault, he could then prevent wool from going to Middleborough instead of Calais, and thus increase their control over the wool trade in Calais. In short, while from the point of view of England's campaign in France to make the infant Henry VI King of France as well as King of England, the Duke of Gloucester's actions were totally detrimental and totally rocking the boat, from London's point of view and everybody in London's point of view, suddenly they're all like, go on, Humphrey, my son. Sweet as a nut. You've got our backing, sunshine. Go get it. So with that in mind, the tale of his adventure in Hainault was actually pretty epic. So far, as we've said, the beginning of the reign had seen Duke Humphrey repeatedly thwarted by the Regency Council and cheated, as he believed, of his right to exercise supreme power in the country. He was, for a time, prepared to transfer his ambitions over to the continent. Now, the opportunity arose because of the presence in voluntary exile in England of the heiress Jacqueline, Countess of Hainault, Holland and Zeeland. Now, she was a protege of Humphrey's older brother, Henry V, who had also made her the godmother of the infant king. Now, you see, originally Henry V had sought to marry her to his brother John, the Duke of Bedford, a fine opportunity to extend English influence into the Low Countries. But her overlord, the Duke of Burgundy, actually had similar ambitions, and he contrived to try to marry her to the Duke of Brabant, and this was her first cousin, and he seized her lands as an incentive. Jacqueline, therefore, was avoiding him by going to England. When she was there, she had found a kindred spirit in Duke Humphrey. By all accounts, they actually did fall in love and arranged to get papal dispensation to allow them marry and remove her from the whole she should marry the Duke of Brabant shenanigans taking place over in Burgundy. Of course, the papal dispensation she gained was from a discredited anti-pope called Benedict XIII, but hey, it's all good. So, now, the Duke of Gloucester wanted to get these regions back for his new wife, and of course, as a husband and under medieval law, for him. In October 1424, Gloucester, now styling himself the Count of Hainault, Holland and Zeeland, left with his wife and an English army to simply conquer her inheritance. Him going meant immediately that his uncle, Bishop Buford, who'd been made Chancellor in 1424, consequently took his place as the principal noble in England, and by the following February of 1425, Buford was actually granted extra monies for his extra duties, as the Regency Council thought the Duke of Gloucester was going to be gone for a while. However, Humphrey was only in the region for another few months. His conquest of Hainault was suddenly cut short when, early in March, Philip, the Duke of Burgundy, issued a personal challenge to fight him in single combat. The fight was supposed to be held on St. George's Day on April 23rd, 1425, an auspicious day for an English prince, I suppose, and he accepted the challenge happily and was preparing for it. But somewhere along the way, it appears his older brother, the Duke of Bedford, facing the prospect of his baby brother getting into a fight to the death with the one man upon whom English policy for the entire war in France depended upon, kind of sidled up to him and said, "What the hell do you think you're doing, Humphrey? No, just no, no, Humphrey, no." Added to that, the Pope, the real one, not one of the anti-popes, forbade the duel, and the English Parliament was refusing to pay for his armies, and so the Duke of Gloucester had to quickly return to England. Yet he was still very much a hero to the Londoners. And the Duke of Gloucester turned up just in time to meet the new Parliament that was to open on the 30th of April, 1425. Now, I understand the Parliament was meant to be a showcase, a public display of unity of the land. Even in the face of the death of their great king, it was going to be a symbolic event showing England had its act together. We can make our small child king ruler of both nations, and the good times they be a-coming. The infant Henry VI was brought into London in state for the occasion, taken from his mother's carriage at St. Paul's by his uncle, the newly returned Duke of Gloucester, and his great-uncle Exeter. The little boy set his feet at the west door of the cathedral, and to the collective of the London residents, he walked into the choir where he was, quote, "born up and offered," unquote. After the great and the good in the cathedral got to go up at this child star of English politics, it was time for the citizens of London to cast eyes upon him. And the young boy was, quote, "set upon a courser," unquote, and his horse was led through Cheapside and the rest of London to Kennington, surrounded by cheering crowds and roars of approval. When Parliament opened, he was seated at the throne in the Painted Chamber at Westminster to hear his Buford great-uncle and Chancellor preach on the text, "Glory, honour and peace to every well-doer." And he went on to give thanks for his peaceful accession to both kingdoms, for the God-given victory over the French, which Bedford had won at Verneuil, and for his subsequent further conquests in France. This entire thing was showing, however, was pure propaganda. Tensions between the Bishop of Winchester and Duke Humphrey
were growing. Buford claimed that a number of reliable persons before, during and after the Parliament warned him that Westminster was unsafe for him to be in, since the Duke of Gloucester intended to commit actual bodily harm upon him. What was worse, when the Duke of Gloucester had been away, the Chancellor's popularity in London had fallen dramatically and fell dramatically during that Parliament. And why? Well, as the Chancellor and principal councillor in Gloucester's absence, the Bishop was considered personally responsible for certain legislations that had just been passed by Parliament. It granted the first levy of tonnage and poundage on imported goods on native merchants. Yep, he started taxing English merchants. Now, the law passed did try to be fair. Yes, this was going to be a direct taxation of London's big merchants, but only on the condition that restrictions were put on the movements and activities of foreign merchants. That sounds fair. Unfortunately, this particular condition, the council over which Buford presided, did not then enforce it. So this pissed off the business interests in London even more. And then Parliament made attendance to the annual general chapters and assemblies of the Masons a felony on the grounds that this defeated the statute of labourers, and they further ordered that that particular law be strictly enforced. All of this pissed off a lot of Londoners, and they being already partisan to Humphrey, things began to escalate a lot. A crowd was said to have gathered at the wharf near the Crane Inn in Vintry, and they threatened to throw the bishop into the river, quote, "to have taught him to swim with wings," unquote. And the bishop was slandered and threatened in placards. And they also threatened foreign merchants. Apparently, some of them nailed a written threat to the door of the Bishop of Winchester's palace down in Southwark. And to this, the bishop claimed that the Duke of Gloucester, after his unexpected return, was encouraging the unrest in the city and driving all this forward. We see bills inciting Londoners to commit violence against the Flemings, which appear in the city early in 1425. It is possible that anti-Flemish sentiment and attacks on the residents of that region within London were being whipped up deliberately in order to antagonise Duke Philip and undermine the Burgundian alliance. The Londoners made no secret of their support of the Duke of Gloucester, while they accused Buford of favouring foreigners. Later that year, they believed it was Buford who obstructed their demands that foreigners should be subjected to hosting laws again. So alarmed was Buford by the temper of the city, he decided to install his own man as custodian of the Tower of London without first consulting the Regency Council. Humphrey decided, as Warden of England and ruler of the nation really, he should move into the Tower of London. But then Bishop Buford instructed his newly appointed constable of the Tower, Sir Richard Wadeville, to keep Gloucester out. Gloucester was rather angry. And in response, the Duke of Gloucester decided to occupy his own tower. Over the years since Blackfriars Priory had been finalised, a new Baynard's Castle had been erected next door to it, close to the site of the old one. And it was this that Humphrey moved into. For the first time since the reign of King John, the Tower of London and Baynard's Castle were now held by opposing forces, the two fortresses of London being held by, well, enemies. Within the City of London, we now have armed men all over the place. The Duke of Gloucester had armed men in the city and clearly had the support of the residents there. In response to this, Bishop Buford raised forces in Southwark and fortified the gate of London Bridge, as well as having his man holding on to the Tower of London. And on October 29th, the day of the elevation of the new mayor, it all kicked off, ostensibly over a pissing contest about who would have custody of the king. The bishop from his palace in Southwark had at his command many men from the shires, Lancashire and Cheshire being mentioned specifically, and he possibly had some men from the king's household who was then based at Eltham. The Duke, as protector of England, summoned to his aid the mayor and 300 armed men from the city, together with the apprentices currently in the Inns of Court. The confrontation inevitably looked to take place on London Bridge, and the two sides marshalled for battle to control the bridge. But fortunately, neither party could cross either the bridge or the river. The Archbishop of Canterbury and the King's cousin, Prince Peter of Portugal, who was then in London, came between them, and due to their persistent and very energetic mediation, they persuaded all the sides to disperse their forces. So, in the end, there was no fight, but the showdown had allowed Gloucester basically, you know, secure custody of the king. On the 5th of November, the Duke of Gloucester celebrated this triumph over his uncle Buford by parading young King Henry through the streets of London again, together with Prince Peter, along with many lords and the mayor and the aldermen, and returned him to Eltham in great pomp. The Bishop of Winchester, for his part, on All Hallows' Eve, in desperate haste and in fear of his life, or so he claimed, penned a letter from Southwark to the Duke of Bedford in France, imploring him to come home as quick as he could, to stop a pitched war and to restrain his unscrupulous younger brother. The four-year-old king may have been completely unaware of the significance of his little ride with his uncle Gloucester through London on November the 5th. But in the following May, he could scarcely have failed to comprehend that there was an acrimonious family feud going on. Bishop Buford had retired to Merton to await the Duke of Bedford's arrival, and he did sail over to England. He and the bishop entered London together in January 1426, escorted by the mayor and the city dignitaries, and they were given separate lodgings in Westminster, one in the palace, one in the abbey. The city bent over backwards to receive the Duke of Bedford and presented him with lavish gifts. But Bedford was not impressed by London and their role in the recent kickoff on London Bridge. For all their generosity to him, they, quote, had but little thanks, unquote. Because of this, London was considered unsuitable as a venue for the urgent reconciliation which Bedford had to bring about between his uncle and his brother. A council meeting was fixed for St. Albans, but Gloucester wouldn't go. Go-betweens, a powerful committee of arbitration, and more failed to bring him to Northampton. And finally, only the most solemn command brought him to a full parliament before the little king himself held that May in Leicester. And here both Gloucester and Buford were given strict instructions to limit and control their retinues, and all men were forbidden to carry weapons. This conflict between the two most important members of the King's Council had threatened serious disorder for London, but it had been smoothed over. However, the hostility towards foreign merchants and the fear they could undermine London's economic revival, coupled with the small chance of gaining greater access to Hainault, basically is what fueled the Londoners' support for the Duke of Gloucester. And that was to have deeper and longer implications for the city. Dick Whittington, 3.5-time Mayor of London, had been the significant figure over the last few decades of London's life. He'd been a political giant in an era of economic depression and contraction, in an era where the Plantagenet dynasty had been toppled and the Lancastrian branch of it had usurped the throne. And he'd been a transitional figure between Richard II and Henry IV going into Henry V. He had ultimately steered the city as a mayor, as an alderman, as a merchant, and as one of the political class of London, skillfully and well. And in his death, he'd become a true exemplar of a civic leader, whose charitable projects and the gifts and beneficiaries of his will had made him a significant role model, elevating him and leading years later to a plethora of tales about him in childhood's puppet shows and ultimately in pantomime. But he was, at the end of the day, a man of a certain era, and that era was over. And in the shadow of his death, a new era was beginning. London was walking with purpose into its future. It's just that they had no idea that the future was about to be catastrophic. Gonna leave it there. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. That's been a bit of a long episode. It was quite difficult to do it. I've got builders in now. Go figure. Anyway, this is Saul, hoping you are well, and I'll see you next week for another chapter in the story of London. Thanks. Bye.